Hello, friends, and welcome to Something to Talk About, a podcast where different people come together to talk about the Word of God and the various ways it applies to our lives. This season, we are talking about the book of Philippians and what it looks like to live a joy-filled life in response to the gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm Amber Barrett, and joining my co-host Aaron and me in conversation today are Sean and Amy Lynch. And Amy, you're going to kick us off by telling us a little bit about how you and Sean met. And then Sean, you get to tell us about how that meeting led to marriage.
I'll correct her.
You said I'll correct her. Okay, this is going to be fun. Go ahead, Amy.
All right. Well, it was 34 years ago in 1990, my freshman year of college at Covenant in chemistry class.
Okay.
Where we first met, and I was sitting in the front row, right in the center, and Sean would sit in the back row. And it was when Sean asked me to tutor him that we finally struck up, you know, a friendship, and we would meet, and Sean would bring me yogurt as a thank you.
It was a bribe.
Well, the real question is, because I already know that Amy's smart, and I know that you're smart too, Sean, but I know Amy's really, really smart. And you were sitting front and center of the class, which says something about what you intended to get out of chemistry, and you were sitting in the back. So my question is, did you ask Amy to tutor you because you really did want to excel in chemistry or because she was cute?
So I failed my first test.
Oh.
And I assumed that Amy passed because she was sitting in the front row and she was a beautiful woman. So I asked her to tutor me as a ruse.
Strategic move.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked.
And it worked. I love it.
Okay, the ruse worked. What was the next step?
I actually asked her out on our first date on Valentine's Day, which was a little bold.
Yeah.
And no pressure.
Took her to a movie.
Mm.
It was, if you remember, Ghost.
Yeah.
That's kind of a romantic movie.
It was an extremely awkward date.
Yeah.
It started snowing while we were in the movie theater, and I had an old convertible, and so driving back up the mountain to Lookout Mountain was a crazy, interesting. We were probably bonded by stress, I think.
Oh, wow.
There's a lot of crazy things about that, and if you're listening and you don't know where Covenant College is, it's on top of Lookout Mountain, and getting up there is twisty, turny, and there's really no guardrails on the side, so if you go over, you're pretty much done. But the fact that you asked around on Valentine's, you watched Ghost, which is about like dead people
right.
in love, and then you drove a convertible up a snow.
Yes, it was a wonder she ever went out with me again. That's for sure.
All right. Well, you had that first date, and then things just progressed from there. How long until y'all were engaged?
It was 3 years. Sean was a year ahead of me, so he graduated, and I had to come back the next year for student teaching, and it was in the summer before my senior year that Sean proposed. Then we were married 6 months later in January of 1994.
Okay. Well, we're going to hear just a little bit more about the two of y'all because I'm going to ask you our first things first question and you're going to answer it. But before you do, you're going to give a little bit more of a bio. So a little bit of a personal bio on who you are. And then you're going to answer the question. And the first things first question is, when was the first time you opened your own bank account?
Well, I was trying to remember that. And I believe it wasn't actually until I was a freshman at Covenant College, even though I had had multiple jobs in high school. I don't remember my first bank account until I was at Covenant because they opened a trailer, literally a trailer bank across the street from the college. And that's when I got my first checkbook and also promptly thereafter bounced a check.
Oops.
So I do remember having to go to a special appointment made for me by like the bank vice president.
Oh.
And I had to go down to Trenton, the back of the mountain where the main branch was, and sit in the office of the vice president where he taught me how to balance my checkbook.
Oh, that's sweet. And then you started charging Sean for tutoring.
Right.
More than yogurt, right?
Yes.
Sean actually had a check cashing business that you'll have to ask him about at Covenant.
Oh, my God.
Which was illegal. And we got a notice from the FCC or whoever regulates banking that we were violating the law.
I mean, the banks had their hands full with you students at Covenant College.
It was called the money table.
Oh,
yes.
Instead of the master's table.
I love it.
The money table seemed more biblical.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, Amy, tell us a little bit about yourself personally. And you can tell us about y'all's family, too, if you want.
Okay. So I was raised in Chicago. My dad was a Delta pilot, and some of you may know him because he's now a member of our church. My mom and dad were divorced since I was probably 6 years old, and it was just my mom and I for most of my upbringing, because my brother, who was special needs, what at the time, our school didn't have the kind of special ed programs that they have now. So he was placed in predominantly residential schools during my childhood. So it was my mom and I for most of my life. And we did not have a family that had any faith background. I mean, I think maybe my grandparents and great grandparents did, but my childhood, I only ever went to church one time, and that was with a friend that I stayed with while my mom was out of town, and she was Catholic. So I went to a Catholic church once, and that was the extent of my exposure to anything regarding Christianity, Jesus, the Bible, until when I was in high school. It was kind of a long story, but I ended up living in Atlanta where my dad was. He had gotten married to someone at the time, and then that's where I had to go live for high school. So when I was in the school in ninth grade, it was like probably my first week at the school when I was invited to youth group from somebody that went to a Methodist church right there near my public school. And so during the rest of high school, I attended that youth group, and it was a wonderful church. It was, you know, sort of an extended family, so to speak, that took me in. And it's really where the first exposure that I had to the gospel, to what it looked like to be a part of a larger family that loved one another, that really, I don't know, I got the support there that I really had missed out on in much of my childhood. But interestingly enough, it wasn't really until a mission trip that I went on in between my junior and senior year of high school that was called Teen Missions International. This was a kind of a dream trip for me, where I had always wanted to go to Africa. And by a strange circumstance, I learned of this opportunity to go to Zimbabwe. And I had been a part of a film crew in my high school where I was, it was sort of like TV productions class. And this particular missions trip was making a Jesus film in Zimbabwe. So I signed up for this trip, and it was on that trip where I committed my life to Christ, where I really intentionally made a decision to follow Jesus. And it was a great experience because that group did emphasize Bible study, prayer, scripture memory in a way that my home church wasn't really interested in it to the same degree. So that's where I sort of began my walk with the Lord, and all of that sort of led me to wanting to go to a Christian college, since I had a lot to learn about the Bible.
And chemistry.
Chemistry.
Of course, you heard how Sean and I met, but I'll let Sean tell his story now.
I was also the product of a divorced family. My father was from upstate New York. My mother was from Detroit. They had settled in Baltimore. And so when my parents divorced, I was maybe six or seven. My mother had not gone to college, didn't really have a job. So we moved into government subsidized housing right outside of DC. My first interaction with the church, because we also did not grow up in a churched family, was a bus route that would come, you know, to the projects and grab all the kids from all the single moms who wanted a day off. And I remember coming home, I was probably 12, and my mother says I walked through the door and my face was completely white. And she asked me what happened, and I told her that I had gotten saved. And she said, saved from what? And I said, hell. And she was so upset that they had like scared this poor little kid that she refused to let us go to church again. But she came to know the Lord. We didn't have a car. And so she would ride the bus to work. And a gentleman on the bus had given her like a Gideon's Bible. So this gentleman and my mother would go through the Gideon's Bible on the way to and from work. And he went to a small community church that we started going to right around the age of 15 or 16. And we then started attending a PCA church plant where the pastor had gone to Covenant College. And I was right about the age I joined the Army National Guard right out of high school. And the only Christian college I had ever heard of was Bob Jones, because my best friend went there. And so I got out of the military on a Friday, started Bob Jones on a Monday, and was kicked out by Wednesday.
I was going to say, wow. I can't see that fitting you real well. Yeah.
I had a two-day Bob Jones introduction, and I remember calling my mom and saying, this place is crazy. I don't know what I've done. I lived in Charles County, Maryland, and I said, call Chuck County Community College, like, just see if they'll let me start school. And she, you know, called me back and said no. And so I had to go to the administration and plead with them to let me stay at Bob Jones. So I did complete a year, but was asked not to return. Mm. And one of my professors had gone to Covenant College, and the church plant my mother was going to, the pastor had gone to Covenant College. So I came home from break and I ended up going to Covenant College. I had never heard of it. I had never even stepped foot on the campus. So like my first day of school was the first day of school.
I love hearing this part of your background. I knew pieces of y'all's story, but hearing you tell it like that, I really enjoy that. Just even as what we're leading up to talk about is going to be helpful. But tell us a little bit about what y'all do now and then what your family looks like.
So we have four children. I came to Augusta, and our first Sunday was Ray Ortland's first Sunday. And we actually came to this church because Ray edited the New Geneva Study Bible, and that was our connection to Augusta. So when I was finishing medical school and looking at places to do residency, we settled on Augusta because there was a church, there was a school, and Ray was here. And so right out of residency, I started my own practice and have been a private physician for 23 years. And my biggest claim to fame is that I have now become Amy Lynch's boss.
Oh,
because she went back to school and got her master's degree in social work. And so she now works in my office as a social worker.
But my initial career was education. I was a math major at Covenant and education minor. And so upon graduating Covenant, I got a job teaching high school math and taught for a number of years. There was a program that was beginning online for getting a master's in social work. So in 2020, I did that and graduated in May of 2023 with my master's. And so I am just now beginning in that field and really enjoying the opportunities for ministry that provides, and really sort of taking on a challenge of learning something completely new at this stage of life, which is a little scary, but it's been exciting.
All right. Well, Sean, you've also got to tell us when you remember opening your first bank account.
Yes. So I was 12 or 13, and my best friend and I started a Washington Post paper route. So we would get up at 4:30. His mother would get up with us because she had a station wagon. We'd sit in the back and we'd throw papers. But back then, we were responsible for collecting the check for the paper route. So back then, there was no internet computer. So you would knock on the door and say, I need your monthly check. And people would give you checks. And so we needed a place to cash it. So we got a checking account.
So I'm trying to remember. I came from a very fiscally conservative household. So having a check account was like a rite of passage. So I definitely remember having one really young, but I don't remember when. I think I've mentioned on here before our little summer hustle of picking okra.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it was like stowaway, our cash from the Piggly Wiggly.
Yeah. When you picked okra to sell it to the Piggly Wiggly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was big time.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember, and I'm sure it's a boring story, but I've got to tell the story instead of when my middle child, Jack, who is 16, just about to be 17, opened his own bank account last summer. And the very day that my husband went with him to open his bank account, his older brother had talked him into going out and playing around a disc golf with this disc golf league that he'd been playing with for the summer. My oldest is really into disc golf. So he said, come on, come play with me. You can use my discs. You can wear my stuff. Let's just do it. So he's like, okay. Well, when you play disc golf in this league, you have an option to buy in for what they call the ace pot. And the ace pot is anytime if you hit a hole in one, first throw, and you get it in the basket, it's called an ace. And it builds throughout the summer because it's really not an easy thing to do. Because when you first throw a disc for disc golf, you're throwing from a long distance away. So to actually make it in is unusual. And my Jack gets out there. He's kind of known, if we believed in luck, we would think that Jack was lucky. He gets out there. He pulls this disc out of Creed's bag. It's not even the right disc. He launches it. Ace.
Oh, my
word.
And
he happens to be, fortunately, playing with one of the guys that heads up the league, because I don't think anybody would have believed it. He won $900 that day for throwing a disc in the basket.
Nice.
So my son Creed was like, of course you did. Of course you did. All the good things happened to you. The day you opened your bank account, you made $900 by throwing a frisbee.
Wow.
Isn't that something? That's great.
I love it.
So we laughed about that. And we did think, you know, good things do tend to happen to Jack. And of course, we all probably think that money means good things, right? Resources mean good things. Here's this 16-year-old. He's got $900 to stick in his bank account. There's a little bit of security going on, a little bit of cause to rejoice. In fact, I think Jack was so happy he laid down in the middle of the street and just sort of lifted his arms to heaven, as in, I have been provided for. And
that's great.
We do think that about money. And it's true. You know, money and resources, they are a gift, but they are limited. And there's other things that are more important. And that's what we're going to learn about a little bit today as we get into the end of this letter of Paul to the Philippians. Paul is eager to make clear to the Philippian believers here at the end of his letter, even as he takes the time to thank them for a gift, a monetary resource gift to him, he's eager for them to remember that resources in life are a good thing. Gifts are a good thing, but they're not the best thing. When we come here to the end of the letter, Paul is ending in a similar way to how he began, because at the beginning of the letter, you'll remember he thanked the Philippian believers for their partnership in this work of the gospel. And here he is ending his letter thanking them for the same thing. Now, if you're listening and you haven't read the passage that we're talking about today, it's Philippians chapter 4, verses 10 through 23. I'd invite you to hit the pause button, listen, come back to it, because you'll get more out of this conversation as you do. And as you're reading through the verses, one thing you're going to notice is Paul is grateful. He is grateful to these Philippian believers. And one of the reasons that he wrote this letter in the first place was to express his gratitude to them. And now here at the end, he's going back again to the tangible ways the Philippians have participated in the gospel work with them, their gift that's bigger than the gift itself, because ultimately it's an act of worship. So Aaron, as we come to this passage today, what are a couple of things that stuck out to you that it's important for us to realize as we proceed?
Yeah, I enjoyed reading through this and just studying through this passage. And a couple of things I think that were interesting as I came across as I was studying this, in that you already mentioned that he had already thanked them in the beginning. And I learned that when I was reading through just some different commentators, that the thanks in the beginning, he was probably dictating, like he was having someone write it down for him. And this is his personal expression. Like maybe now he's got the pen and he's putting down his personal expression of thanks. I thought that just gave it a new warmth, a new little nuance and dynamic to that. And I love here how we've already talked about Jesus as the prize, but here we are reminded in a different light that, like you said, resources are good. God knows that we need stuff. We need food. We need clothes. We need, you know, lodging. These type of things are basic human needs. And he delights in being generous towards us. And what we see here, Paul is saying, thank you for the gift, but almost with that intonation of, I'm so glad to see you growing to be in more likeness of the Lord. Like he is generous towards us, and you give out of your poverty, you give generously because you've been moved by the Lord. And I love that he's reinforcing that idea of generosity. Where we put our treasure is where our heart is. I think he's kind of fleshing out some of that Sermon on the Mount idea there too. And that his joy is in the Lord. He's rejoicing for them or with them to the Lord because he sees that they are growing in his likeness.
Well, Aaron, I like how you point out the fact that the Lord knows that we need stuff. You know, we need certain things, and he promises to provide those things. And he actually uses the body of Christ in order for us to provide things to one another as an act of service. And that's something that we should be grateful for and should enjoy participating in, because we're doing it out of an overflow of the love of the Lord, for the Lord and for one another. So Sean and Amy, can y'all describe a time when y'all experienced the blessing of someone supporting you, and what was most valuable to you about their gift?
Well, Sean and I talked about this earlier when we were at the stage of life when Sean was in medical school. I was working as a teacher, and at the time made enough for both of us to live on, with the exception of the loans that had to be taken out for the medical school, et cetera. But when our first child was born, was in Sean's third year of medical school. So during that period of time, I stepped back from full-time work. And that was a huge, scary thing to do because we were surviving off of my income only, which then went down to $15,000 a year. Mm. And so in 1998, $15,000 was not enough to live on.
Yeah.
And so we were at the point of taking out more loan money or using a credit card. We probably could have educated ourselves around social services, but we just decided to figure this out on our own. But it was a scary time. And we, during that period, we attended Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church, which was connected to the school where I was teaching, Westminster Academy. And one of my fellow teachers had a child. I can't remember if it was a daughter or a son.
It was a daughter.
Her daughter had expressed a desire to go to medical school down the road. And when she saw our situation, pretty much everybody knew that we were in dire straits and surviving off of pennies. She handed me a check one day, unexpected, out of the blue. And it was, I don't remember the exact amount, but I remember it was a significant amount of money that made a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And she placed this in my hand and said, I feel like the Lord has told me that you need this and we are to give this to you. And I am kind of looking at this as sowing forward a blessing to you that maybe one day, if it's the Lord's desire for my daughter to go to medical school, which she has expressed, that maybe the Lord will see and bless my daughter in a way. It was just, it was a very moving thing to see her responding out of what she felt was obedience to the Lord saying, I want you to give this gift, which really did fill a huge need in our lives at that time.
Well, and even that she, if she knew her daughter wanted to go that direction, I'd be saving up some pennies because it's not cheap, but that she was willing to support that, knowing that's what you were already involved in. That's what the Lord had already called you to. She saw the value in that and wanted to contribute. And by faith thought, if the Lord has that for my daughter, he'll supply as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we see here Paul's talking about how he's grateful for the gift that the Philippians sent to him and he appreciates it. But he's also saying in that same breath that he's content. And I think when we read that in the English language, like we have an idea of what content means or satisfaction. But I found it super interesting when I was reading through some of the Greek that that idea shows up as self-sufficiency. And I was like, huh, that's really interesting, because I feel like in even in this church, I've come to an awareness, a greater awareness, like self-sufficiency. It's not helpful. It's not the gospel. So I was so curious to double click on that and learn a little bit more. And the thing that came to the surface is, I think Paul was trying to relate to his first century Christian reader. So the Stoic philosophers of that day, they would have this idea of self-sufficiency, and he referred to it as a defiant scorn. And so the Stoic philosopher would look at the world and say, I am independent, I am self-sufficient, and with a defiance about him. And so Paul is playing into that word of self-sufficiency. So they would have heard that word and known that conversation that is backloaded into that. But he's articulating that his self-sufficiency is a dependence upon the Lord. Like he immediately plays into the fact that I am independent of the world or of my circumstances to inform my standing before the Lord. And I found that so refreshing to just say that we are content because we rest upon the Lord and his provision, and nothing that we're showing up with or no defiance or grittiness that we can show up with is going to triumph. So I found that really interesting as I was reading and studying that. And we're going to talk about one of the most misquoted verses probably in all of, the whole New Testament. You want to say, like,
it's pretty close.
It's up there, especially if you've ever been in the sports world. You maybe have a shirt that says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, like hit home runs and I don't know, buzzer beaters, this type thing is more of the tone of that. So we want to talk about, what does it mean as we read that as believers? Like, what is the real essence of that verse and how we've learned that lesson for ourselves? Amy, you want to start us off?
Sure. So I tried to translate that verse into like my own words when I was reading that question. And I rewrote it to say, I can prevail over any situation because of being continually strengthened in my relationship with Jesus. So these situations that are difficult, faith testing, overwhelming, where we're faced with our own limitations and especially lack of control. And so that's really sort of, it's sort of a bigger context than just like what you're, you know, what we see on the athletic t-shirt for sure. I do have some fun stories to share. As I explained earlier, that I had not grown up in a family that taught me the things of the Lord. I had no exposure to the Bible, to Christianity, to Jesus, and felt very self-sufficient. Because when you grow up in a family where there's some brokenness and you're going between homes, you become very independent. And even your like emotions and how you handle struggle is, yeah, this isn't affecting me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's talk about stoicism.
Mm-hmm.
But what I didn't know about myself is all of what I needed to learn to become conformed to the image of Christ after college, you know, really sort of still as a new believer, probably 4 or 5 years into my faith, really was tested in our first year of marriage. Because even though I had grown up in a family with, you know, some emotional struggles with parents that weren't getting along, were divorced, there was a lot of strife there between them relationally, I never had to wonder where my next meal was coming from. I always had a roof over my head, a really nice roof over my head. I think my parents actually tried to overcompensate by giving us a lot materially. So that was opposite of Sean's upbringing. So really in our first year of marriage is where I did learn how to be content in want, not having much. I was waiting tables at Ruby Tuesdays and I was looking for a teaching job, but we were surviving off very little. And so my funny story is that I went on a hunger strike. I would not be content with what we had in the house to eat for dinner. We had no money. We couldn't go buy groceries. We couldn't go eat out. And what we had were hot dogs and canned spinach. And I was not going to have hot dogs and canned spinach for dinner. So I was not going to eat. And that was just something I look back on and now can laugh. But at the time, just that anger, that hardness of heart. And I remember really like looking at Sean and being humbled because he was very content with canned spinach and hot dogs. And
because
that's not,
they're good.
But, you know, just that difference in our upbringing, because he did know what it felt like to be hungry.
I mean, it really was, Amy said, let's go out to dinner. We have nothing to eat. And I said, we have plenty to eat. And I opened up the refrigerator and there was a package of hot dogs. And then I went into the pantry and we had several cans of spinach. And so I just started boiling water and opened up a can of spinach. And Amy said, then I'm not eating, and stomped upstairs. And I remember thinking, man, I married somebody who maybe had a little bit more money growing up than I did. But I never worried because, I mean, we didn't have any money, but we always ate. I mean, there would be days where somebody would just drop off a box of food at our house. And so I knew that God wasn't going to let me go hungry. So,
Amy, do you think you were striking out against Sean or against the Lord, or could you parse it out? Or you just were mad?
I don't know that I thought that deeply about it. I think I was confronted with how ungrateful I was and how I never had to struggle.
Mm-hmm.
I think we called it spoilt.
Spoilt.
She was spoilt.
And I think Paul is alluding to that because he's experienced the poverty and he has experienced the fuller life, that it's almost like he's saying, I've found the secret sauce to being content. And that is depending upon the Lord and being grateful, like you were talking about, and just knowing that he does provide for our needs, and us coming with that gratitude, I think is he's giving us that idea of the secret is not our circumstances, because mm-hmm. those are going to ebb and flow for most mm-hmm. of us, that the secret is depending upon the Lord, trusting mm-hmm. in him.
Yeah, he really used having children
mm-hmm.
in my life was sort of my sanctification of learning how to be content and grateful on very, very little.
Mm-hmm.
There was a store on Central Avenue back in the early 2000s called Ready to Wear Again. And it was a consignment store. And one day a month in the back of the store, they had a $1 sale. Everything was $1 on this one rack. You know, that's where I shopped for my clothes through Sean's residency when we first moved to Augusta. And I had small children. I was grateful to be able to buy clothes off that rack once a month. And that was a huge change in really a short amount of time, 4 years time, from going on a hunger strike with hot dogs and canned spinach to being happy that I could buy an outfit for a couple bucks. And also figuring out how to feed our family on, you know, relatively little. I think Sean at that point in time made like $26,000 a year. And we had a family of five. And then shortly thereafter, my brother came to live with us. So it was, and then it was became fun. It actually became kind of fun to take the calculator to the grocery store and figure out how to stretch the dollars and not bounce another check to have to, you know, make it work. And that was fun to see that progress.
Yeah. And that's a work of the Lord. I think that's even what Paul is saying here to the Philippians. Like, I rejoice in the work that the Lord has done in you, that you are able to give generously. And that is the fruit of the Spirit working at you and working in you. So I see that there. That's beautiful.
And don't you like the fact that Paul himself says, I learned it? Not like, I came out, you know, I've always known this, but I learned it. Like, he would have had to live in those circumstances where he felt like he had plenty and where he felt like he had want. Those are the places in which we learn that secret of contentment. And you learned that the Lord was with you in that place, the love of your family, the love of the Lord, the things that superseded the things themselves, and it put the things in a different place, and you were able to see it in a different way. But it's hard to learn that lesson until you're in it.
That's true.
And so I think it's kind of the Lord that we get to learn all the way throughout life.
Yeah. And see his strength show up in that space and in our weakness.
Well, and I think that's part of the reason Paul, he's not hesitant to tell the Philippian believers here how much he personally is grateful for their gift, but he's emphasizing the fact that there's more to the gift because he doesn't want them to misunderstand or to think that, hey, if it weren't for you, I'd really be in dire straits here, or I really need this from you. Let's remember next year so you can really do that again. I'm dependent on you. He wants them to have the freedom of giving in worship. And that's really what Paul is celebrating in these verses is, man, you are doing this as an act of worship, and I am so grateful to see that. Kind of like you mentioned, Aaron, like, you're doing this because you belong to the Lord, and this is an overflow of what that means. And so he's delighting in that. Can y'all describe for yourselves, and you've gone through different seasons of life of which you found yourself in different places, as you've already described, what does it look like now in y'all's lives to be moved to give sacrificially by gratitude that you have for the gift of Jesus Christ in your life?
I think for us, coming from broken families, it's looked a lot more like helping our families. So, you know, we're in situations where a lot of people in our family have needed a lot of help over the last several years, and just kind of having the understanding that we're called to serve our family. And that has looked different ways at different times, but I think it all began. I was actually in Guatemala on a mission trip, and Amy was in a Bible study, and I remember calling her the night we were going to fly home, and Amy just basically said, hey, do you care if my brother lives with us? And Amy can talk more about what triggered that, but I think for me, that was the time at which I just kind of felt like throughout our life, God was going to have us do maybe a little bit more than was normal for our families.
Explain what that looked like then, Amy.
Yeah, I was in a Bible study with Mary Watts. And all of our children were little. I think our oldest might have been 4. And then Ellie was 2. And Kate was like newborn. And Sean was in residency. And we were studying James. And there's a verse in James, it's 2:15-16, that says, if any one of you has a brother who is without daily food or clothes, and you say to him, oh, I wish you well, and you don't attend to their needs, you know, how can you say that you have faith? And at the time, my brother, who is 3 years older than me, and he has special needs. And as I alluded to earlier, he was pretty much in different schools that were like boarding-like schools that attended to his needs growing up. And then he ended up in a group home outside of Atlanta where it was very poorly run. His roommate at the time was placed somewhere else. So he's living alone, no transportation. At the time, he was without a job. And he would call us every day, ask us what we were having for dinner. And it was pretty clear that he was not getting regular groceries. And we became concerned about his situation. And then the Lord just very clearly laid it on my heart that he was supposed to come live with us. And it really wasn't something that I questioned. I needed to know if, you know, Sean was going to be on board, but I just like really knew this is what God was calling us to do. And yeah, so he did. And at the time we lived in this little ranch house. We had a screened in porch that was closed in and we made it a bedroom for our children so that my brother could take one of the other bedrooms. It was just, you know, kind of one of those crazy things that if like, you know, of a family that's doing something, you're sort of like concerned about them. I don't think this is going to be a good idea, but okay. And that's kind of what it was. But, you know, now fast forward 23 years, Brian has been like the biggest blessing to our family. And yeah, so it's just, and that was, that's, you know, I think what you get when you step out in faith and do what God's calling you to do.
Well, I wish you could sometimes see the podcast, because when you can see people tear up, they don't always want you to see them tear up, but it is just an expression of physical expression of what's coming out of your heart with that. And I appreciate that. And I was thinking, as you're saying that, when I was studying this verse, I was thinking a little bit about just when Jesus is teaching on the cost of following him. And Peter says something to the effect of, well, how about us, Lord? Like, we've given up all these things to follow you. So basically, what's coming our way? You know, and Jesus just makes that gentle point that nobody who's ever given up these things will fail to receive much more, not just in the life to come, but in the life now, just sort of stomping out that idea that this is sort of, we give in order to receive something for the Lord, or like the Lord owes us something. There's some sort of self-righteousness, or aren't we so giving, or aren't we so whatever? But no matter what it is we give, the Lord so amply supplies for us. And so just to hear that description, that's what you're saying, bringing Brian into your home really was. It was a big sacrifice and commitment for y'all to do that. And yet what you gained through it was so much more, so that you would never be like, yeah, look at us. We really did make a big sacrifice in life, pat ourselves on the back. But praise the Lord, we made a sacrifice in our lives, and look what he did. It's just beautiful.
Yeah. Well, now things look a lot different. The Lord has blessed us in other interesting ways, you know, because about a year and a half ago, our mom moved to Augusta. And so when our mom moved here, Brian quickly decided that, you know, he ditched us.
He did. She took better care of him.
He did. And she is, you know, our mom is loving every minute of that.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, so it's just really cool. Like seasons of life, you know, things change, and what you're called to do changes with different seasons of life.
Yeah.
So for that season of life, that was a huge blessing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now we're on a different season of life where everyone has ditched us.
And it's wonderful.
And you're living the good life.
Yes.
I love hearing you tell that story, Amy, and just being reminded that it is the Lord's love that is our reward. And like you were pointing out, Amber, it's not like we're over here trying to balance the scale or ask the Lord, like, okay, is he going to ante up if I increase my sacrificial giving? But it is just I think when our hearts are moved to generosity or to sacrificial giving, it's nothing in and of ourselves. It is because we are compelled to love in such a way, because we have been loved in such a magnificent way. We've experienced the Lord's generosity in such a way that we cannot help but move in that direction. It's not of our own nature. It is evidence of the Lord's work in us. And as I'm just thinking of us finishing up Philippians and how we started off this series just talking about joy and what a joy it is to grow in the Lord, to know more of his love, to know more of his presence. And it has truly been, I think, even just walking through this, just a joy to study these verses.
Absolutely. Amy and Sean, we're glad that the two of you decided to join us for this last episode and flesh out a little bit for us what it looks like to live a joy-filled life in response to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Listeners, we have come to the end of this season in Philippians, but we hope you'll plan to join us in the summertime. We are going to be doing a short summer series talking about the book, A Place to Belong, Learning to Love the Local Church by Megan Hill. We hope you'll listen in.
Sometimes a light surprises the Christian while she sees. It is the Lord who rises with healing in his wings. When comforts are declining, he grants the soul again a season of clear shining to cheer it after the rain.